You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, hackers were able to gain access to a number of high-profile Twitter accounts, including those of Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden and Microsoft founder Bill Gates, in an attempt to scam people out of Bitcoin. We'll talk to a cybersecurity reporter about the hack and what it could mean for security surrounding our elections. Now, in a recent Supreme Court ruling, the nation's highest court determined that nearly half of the land in Oklahoma is effectively under tribal jurisdiction. This could change how laws are implemented in the eastern part of that state. The McGirt versus Oklahoma case was brought by Jimsy McGirt, a member of the Seminole Nation, who was convicted of a sex crime on Creek land. He argued that given the land treaties between the U.S. government and the Muscogee Nation, that the state didn't have jurisdiction in his case. In the majority opinion, Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote, quote, "We are asked whether the land these treaties promised remains an Indian reservation for purposes of federal criminal law. Because Congress has not said otherwise, we hold the government to its word," end quote. Our next guest joins us to talk about the precedent this ruling could set and how tribal, state, and federal laws have conflicted in the past. Richard Manette is professor of law at UW-Madison. He's also director of the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center. Richard, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Well, can you tell us a little more about what was at stake in this U.S. Supreme Court case?
Well, you know, a lot was at stake. So, and the court hit some of it right on the head. The court missed some of it. So, you know, it's fair to say that it's a pretty good win for the tribe. I'm sure the Muscogee Creek Nation feels like it won, and I think largely that's true. But, you know, it has its downside. So, I mean, there's so much at stake. Anything in particular you're wondering?
Well, one thing I think people may have seen headlines and maybe misread reading this as, wait, does this mean that tribal groups own half of the land in Oklahoma? That's not what came out of this. Do I have that right?
You do have that right. So I suppose we could say, you know, if we start with the facts, okay, so these tribes, a few of them were removed from the southeast of America into the Indian Territory, which became Oklahoma, Indian country today. And, you know, through history, a couple of events in particular, they frankly lost much of that. But what they lost and what they retained is what's at issue, and it's confusing to people, including to me, and it's evidently confusing to the court. So are we talking about territory or property here? And they went back and forth, and so it's going to, in some ways, cause more confusion than it alleviates. But we can say, you know, this was a case about criminal jurisdiction. It's pretty clear that the tribe has strengthened its position about prosecuting crimes committed by its own citizens in that area that was called the reservation at one point. And that's huge for them, right? Because, I mean, when people commit crimes, they're violating somebody's laws. And laws come from norms and values, so they're violating somebody's norms and values. If they're violating the state of Oklahoma's norms and values, those may or may not be the same as the Muscogee Creek norms and values. So, you know, when you get to prosecute your own crimes, you're governing yourselves, you're governing people's conduct. What you're essentially doing is you're imposing your own cultural norms and values in a territory, and in that way, culture, you know, lives. So that's huge for them. Make no mistake about that. And that actually will probably overlay into the civil cause of action arena, you know, contract disputes, certainly between its own people, whether or not the Creek Nation, quote unquote, owns land, or whether or not their citizens own the land. It might even be totally non-native owned. But nonetheless, now it's inside a reservation. So the Muscogee Creek Nation courts may have jurisdiction over those civil causes of action. But it quickly gets, you know, the confusion quickly rears its ugly head when you think about that third kind of jurisdiction in American law, other than criminal and civil cause of action. You think of regulatory. Now what, right? So who's going to set the speed limits there? You know, who's going to set the water quality limits? And speeders generally don't pay attention to property lines or even territory lines. And, you know, water pollution doesn't either. So who's going to do that there? Is this really territory where this Muscogee Creek Nation is going to govern territorially the way Wisconsin does? Or is this Muscogee Creek Nation really just a property owner? And, you know, so property owners do what they can to, well, pollute and or protect waters in their property, but they're not a government. You know, make no mistake about that. So the confusion will start right away with that kind of thing.
Is this something that is only going to affect Muskogee land within the boundaries of Oklahoma, or does this set a precedent for other tribal groups and other states?
Well, it certainly will apply to the similarly situated First Nations there in Oklahoma, the so-called five civilized tribes in particular, along with Muskogee removed to Oklahoma, Cherokee, Choctaw, Seminole, Chickasaw as well. But, you know, the part that the Native leaders are rejoicing in, frankly, the most, is the court going back to some rather strong language from, you know, all the way back to Hugo Black when he said, great nations like great men should keep their word. You know, the court said, yeah, we can't tell Congress what it can and cannot do sort of on the international sort of plane. But we can make it clear that unless Congress expressly dissolves, diminishes this reservation, it's there. And so once we find it's there, if we don't find somewhere where Congress has done this, then it's still there. Now, you know, you're in Wisconsin, so I hope I probably don't have to shake that tree very hard for people to think, okay, are we talking Oneida and the state of Wisconsin, or at least the village of Hobart now making this precise argument that the Oneida Reservation has been disestablished? Yes. And this opinion will now bode very strongly in those disputes.
Talking to Richard Monette, professor of law at UW-Madison and director of the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center, looking at a new U.S. Supreme Court ruling on, in effect, tribal sovereignty in Oklahoma, and as we just heard, maybe beyond. Richard, is part of this holding the United States to treaties signed with different tribal groups around the country, observing those as having, you know, the force of an international treaty, and as you say, unless overturned by Congress, still in effect?
That's precisely what it's doing. It sort of re-internationalized these treaties, saying, you know, the states, you do not have the authority to do this, either abruptly with some state law and state action, or through the force of time, you know, as the court almost said, tiptoeing up to the boundary and pushing it inward over time. You just don't get to do that. And, you know, there's some language like that, too, in the opinion. There's this old case called Kagama from the 1800s. And, you know, it's said, well, the people in the states are often their deadliest enemies. That's precisely what the court said here. Imagine, the court said, if the states could do that. Almost in those words, which is the kind of language we just haven't heard from the court that I think America needs to hear. Or the tribes need to. This is, you know, it was getting to a point where, look, America, decide. Either you've conquered and they're done, or you actually believe in this sovereignty and their culture a bit, and that they have something to teach us, and, you know, they have a right to be here. Then it's time to decide, right? And so the court took the path that certainly the tribal leaders appreciate.
Richard, as we wrap up, do you expect this decision now to open up a lot of new court action, taking this Supreme Court decision as a precedent around the country?
Well, I do. And really, that's the bad and the ugly part, other than, you know, of course, endless work for lawyers, which they appreciate and which I helped to produce. So that, in some ways, I suppose I shouldn't think that's all bad. But I'll tell you, there's a thorn in here where the court said the Creek and the treaty reserved territory, but they were asked, it kind of put the onus on them, whether they wanted a patent and to hold it in fee simple. And that's language of property, not territory. You know, sovereigns don't own property. You know, they don't deal in titles. They own territory and they extinguish them or conquer them, you know, that sort of thing. So very much the language in here is about sort of treating the Muskogee Creek Nation more as a property owner, less as a sovereign. And in the long run, that is not good for the Muskogee Creek Nation or any of Indian country. And there's enough language in this opinion to really cause problems, lawsuits and coming down on both sides of the aisle on this one.
A lot to
so,
watch.
You know, it seems like a huge win up front, but there will be problems.
Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. I really appreciate you inviting me on.
Richard Monette is a professor of law at UW-Madison and director of the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center. He joined us today for a look at a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in favor of tribal sovereignty. In some ways, though, he sees some maybe unexpected consequences along the way. Coming up, we'll talk about a Twitter hack that targeted high-profile politicians, business owners, and more, and what it could signal about the state of our election security. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the economic damage from the COVID-19 outbreak is leading to problems in housing, with many missed mortgage and rent payments and people at risk of eviction in the coming months. We'll hear about the scope of the problem and possible solutions. First, the Twitter accounts of several high-profile public figures were hacked as part of a widespread scam aimed at getting Bitcoin from their followers. Accounts included those of Elon Musk, Kanye West, and Barack Obama. The hackers used the platforms of these public figures, pretending to solicit donations. They promised to give back double what they received from donors. Some estimates say the hackers made more than $118,000 in Bitcoin before Twitter realized the security breach. The hack itself showed how social media platforms like Twitter could be vulnerable to attack. It also raised red flags for cybersecurity experts who say this could jeopardize the security of elections and spread even more disinformation. For example, one of the accounts hacked belonged to presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. Eric Geller is a reporter who covers cybersecurity and election security, among other things, for Politico. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this was a big deal. All these accounts on the Twitter side of things, all these accounts hacked. Can you give us a sense of the scope of this problem?
Well, I mean, the accounts really ran the gamut. So as you mentioned, we have entertainment figures, we have politicians, a presumptive presidential nominee. And what you saw in those early hours was people sort of grappling with just how widespread this was. And it seemed like every few minutes, a new account was being taken over until they got things under control.
And let's talk about what we know about how it happened. It sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, they didn't get Joe Biden's personal Twitter login from him or Kanye West from him. This happened, the call came from inside the house, basically, at Twitter.
That's right. So what they've said so far is that they believe that someone was able to get into the accounts of their employees by tricking them into handing over their passwords, although there is some reporting that some of the hackers might have bribed employees into turning over access to the accounts.
Do we have any thoughts as to who was behind this, what looks like a kind of sophisticated effort?
Well, you know, this is the million-dollar question, right? So in the early hours of this, there was some speculation that, oh, just given who was hacked and how many of them were hacked, it's got to be a nation state. It's got to be a foreign government like China or Russia. But then people started saying, well, if you had this ability to get into these powerful Twitter users or Twitter employees' accounts, wouldn't you save that for something a little bit more destructive, something that could tank the stock market, change an election? I mean, you're not just going to try to raise $118,000 in Bitcoin. And so right now, I think if you ask most experts who study these kinds of scams, they're likely to predict that it is a criminal group. It's not necessarily the hardest thing to trick somebody into turning over their password. That's certainly what the Russian hackers did with John Podesta in 2016, the Clinton campaign chairman. So it's not necessarily the most sophisticated attack. I think the question now for Twitter is, what do they do to change their security precautions so that nobody can do this again?
Talk about how Twitter reacted in the moment. What did they do to try to stop the flow here?
Well, this was really interesting. So one of the things that they did is they disabled the ability of verified Twitter users. Those are the users with the little blue check mark. They said, you're not allowed to tweet for a while we get this under control. And that had some interesting side effects because, first of all, news organizations like my own were not able to cover the news on Twitter. But then also a lot of government accounts that are used for weather and crime and news alerting were not able to send those alerts as well. So there was a tornado warning in Illinois, and the National Weather Service regional Twitter account was not able to communicate about that. In the grand scheme of things, we don't necessarily know how damaging that was, that inability to tweet in that particular case. But it was this moment of kind of realizing, wow, you know, this is a very powerful platform. It's almost unprecedented how many people's lives are touched by the ability or inability to communicate on this site.
One prominent Twitter user wasn't affected. President Donald Trump, his account was not affected. And it looks like there's special treatment for his account at Twitter because of concerns of interference there.
That's right. And in fact, in 2017, there was an incident where a Twitter employee who was on the way out froze the president's account for a few minutes, essentially deleted it, or it looked like it had been deleted. So there's a reason that Twitter wants to protect the president's account. I think the question in the coming days and weeks is going to be, why is it just the president's account that gets whatever special, you know, protections it happens to have?
Eric Geller is with us from Politico, looking at the hack yesterday of a bunch of Twitter accounts of big name people. Hackers used it in an attempt, apparently, to raise money via Bitcoin. Eric, I got to say, seeing this thing pop up, it looked like a scam. It didn't look like something that was going to generate people millions of dollars. But I guess the question is, if they could do it, somebody else could do it. What are the concerns about more nefarious uses of this kind of attack?
Yeah, I mean, that really points to Twitter in terms of what are they going to change? Are they going to require more sort of security steps, more hurdles for their employees to clear before they can do things to certain accounts? So one possibility here is that once the hackers got into the employee accounts, they were able to change the email addresses linked to Biden's account, Bloomberg's account, and that would then let them, the hackers, reset the password by sending the reset email to their email address and then get in and tweet as if they were the right owner of the account. So that's one possibility here, and there are many possibilities. And the question for Twitter is, how are you going to prevent this from happening again? Because your employees need to have the ability to do things like changing email addresses, freezing accounts. You know, there are a lot of reasons why those powers exist, but it's this delicate dance, because you could certainly bribe an employee to do something they're not supposed to do, or you could just take over the employee's account, and there's no way to completely prevent either of those things. The question is, do we have some kind of, you know, a two-man rule, like, you know, with launching nuclear weapons from a submarine? How do you make sure that Twitter is as safe and is as sort of impervious to this type of malfeasance as possible?
I think a lot of times the movie imagery of hacking is, you know, the sophisticated person with their high-tech gear set up, hacking in remotely to the Pentagon or the company or whatever. This social engineering threat, they call it, exploiting the weakness of people revealing their passwords or whatever, that seems to be the bigger threat.
Absolutely. If I could leave your listeners with one thought, it would be most hacking that happens today with, you know, devastating consequences like in 2016 is not the kind of thing that you saw in, you know, the 1980s movie War Games, where the guy is sitting at the computer and he types this inscrutable code and then he says, you know, I'm in, and then he launches the missile or whatever. It's mostly sending somebody an email that looks like it's from Google saying reset your password. You click on the link, you say, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what happened here. Well, I guess I'll just type in my password to recover access to my account. And, you know, boom, the hacker has your account. That is how most of this stuff happens. It's the easiest, lowest hanging fruit imaginable. And if I could turn this into an object lesson, it would be think very carefully about the links that you click on and where you're typing in your password.
Now, if this could happen at Twitter, who's to say, you know, an employee at Facebook with a much huger reach couldn't be turned for something like this?
That's right. I sometimes think that it is just, you know, there but for the grace of God that other sites haven't seen this exact kind of thing. We do have examples from, you know, Facebook, MySpace, Snapchat in the past of insiders abusing their power to spy on, you know, ex-girlfriends or whatever. We haven't yet seen something like this, where the hackers are able to trick an employee into turning over their account, and that person isn't necessarily corrupted. It's just that their account's been stolen. I don't necessarily know why that is. Perhaps Facebook has a multi-level system for making certain changes, and Twitter doesn't. But I think Twitter, you know, the question for Twitter in the next few weeks is, do we have to reorganize our entire system of how we allow people to control the accounts on our site?
Now, Twitter theoretically is going to be investigating itself. Are there investigations going on by law enforcement? Whose jurisdiction is this? Who tackles a problem like this?
So what we know right now is that the FBI San Francisco field office is investigating Twitter headquartered in that area. They're going to look into this. I don't necessarily know how much data Twitter will have that they can turn over that will help the FBI figure out who this is. But that's one possible avenue for the FBI to figure out who it is. That's again, on the list of big questions that we have out there. Who did this is one of the biggest. If this truly was just an attempt to steal Bitcoin and not a diversion from something else, then I think that's a pretty open and shut example of cybercrime, sort of garden variety cybercrime. But the scale of this, the way in which they did it, it almost, you know, defies belief that they could have gone through all this trouble just to steal some money through Bitcoin.
What are we hearing from members of Congress? I know some are calling on Twitter for some at least explanations.
Yeah, that's right. So multiple committees have asked for briefings. Senate Intelligence Committee, which has studied the Russian hacking and misinformation in 2016, they're obviously very concerned about further abuse of this platform. The House Oversight Committee has asked for a briefing. And then you have several lawmakers sending their own letters basically saying this is unacceptable. And I think what's important to remember is they're also worried about their own accounts, because it wouldn't look good for any of them, especially the ones who are running for re-election, if, you know, in late October, somebody stole one of their tweets and tweeted out something horrible, especially on election day when there's very little time for them to come back and say, oh, no, that wasn't me. Somebody hacked into my account. And then, of course, some people wouldn't believe that explanation anyway. This is a very fraught issue for politicians who have essentially outsourced a lot of their communications to these private platforms. And on a day-to-day basis, we tend to think, oh, you know, we're tweeting, it's our communications, but there is a middleman there. There is a company that, if it is co-opted, can get in the way and really change not only how we're communicating, but also in some cases what we're saying.
Briefly, last 30 seconds here, Eric, apart from the whodunit, what are you watching for next?
I'm watching for what Twitter does to change account management. They've got a tough problem on their hands here.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Geller is a reporter who covers cybersecurity and election security at Politico. He joined us today to talk about this massive Twitter hack that targeted high-profile public figures for a Bitcoin scam, apparently, and what the hack could mean for elections and more. Coming up, we'll look at a potential housing crisis in the U.S. and possible ways to prevent it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, there's been a long effort to restore the whooping crane flock that migrates in and out of Wisconsin. Kate Archer-Kent gets an update on the Wisconsin whoopers. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, COVID-19 has done a lot of economic damage alongside the widespread risks to health. Our next guest says that the economic fallout has pushed us to the edge of a housing crisis, making an existing problem even worse. Even before COVID-19, housing costs were eating up a big portion of people's budgets. For homeowners, one mortgage data company says 4.3 million Americans missed their mortgage payments in May. That's up from 2 million at the end of March. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, covering economics, technology, and the media. He's also the author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, and host of the Crazy Genius podcast. Derek, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
You write in your piece on this, Derek, that COVID didn't necessarily just cause a housing crisis. It escalated one that was already brewing. Can you talk about pre-COVID, what we saw when it came to housing?
Pre-COVID, what we saw when it came to housing is that we're not building enough houses. And when I say houses, I mean single-family houses, like, you know, houses with lawns. And I mean multifamily houses, like apartment buildings and condo buildings. We just weren't building enough. And it's somewhat ironic, you could say, because one of the issues that we had in 2006 to 2008 during the housing crash that gave us the Great Recession, that was partly because we had sort of, you know, there were too many houses that went on the market. People felt like we had overbuilt in the previous decade. Well, in the last decade, we've underbuilt. And as a result, you know, supply and demand, when the supply is constricted, prices go up. And so, rental prices went up for a lot of people, went up for a lot of low-income Americans who found themselves more stretched to afford the rent. And so we had a slow-motion housing crisis to that extent happening before the pandemic. And what's happened now, obviously, is that tens of millions of people have lost their jobs. They have had their income supplemented by the federal government in terms of its unemployment insurance, the $600 per week bump up. They've gotten their $1,200 checks. But now all of that cash that came with the CARES Act passed in March, it's coming up against a cliff. And Congress has not authorized a new CARES Act, new spending to help people afford to stay in their homes. And that as a result means that we seem to be on the edge of an eviction cliff. So you put it all together, you had 10 years of not building enough houses, you had a pandemic, and now you have a Congress that is dithering when it needs to be helping Americans afford the rent that is already too high.
On top of that, Cliff, there's also the notion that we had these moratoria on evictions, either and some mortgage forgiveness for federally backed mortgages, the rental and eviction moratorium for federally subsidized housing, and also state level moratoriums on evictions. Those are coming to an end, too, right over the next few months.
That's right. There's a money half of this equation and there's a rules half of this equation, or a law half of this equation. So the money half is pretty simple to state, maybe harder to do in practice. We need to find ways to give people more money or continue to give them money so that they can continue to afford to pay the rent, even if their jobs don't immediately come back in the pandemic. And then on the rules and the law side, we need to extend a lot of eviction moratoriums, or moratoria, I guess would be the Latinate plural. We need to do it now. This is not something where you can afford to be a little bit late. People can be kicked out of their apartments, and homelessness is an absolute human tragedy, and it's inexcusable in a country that has access to so much money and so much wealth that we have the homelessness crisis that we already have. Exacerbating it is unacceptable. You want to both extend the cash side of this and the legal side of it as well.
And let's talk about who this is hitting. You wrote in your piece that lower income people in particular were paying things like, 20-30% of their income just on their housing costs, their rent or maybe mortgage. And in many cases, they are the people who are likely to lose their jobs.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There was a study, I believe, from the Furman Center that essentially looked at this question in New York City specifically and found that the households who are most likely to face what they called a, quote, economic disruption, losing a job, having your hours cut back, were the most likely to have spent the highest share of their income on housing. So the people who were most housing burdened were also those who were most pandemic burdened. It's a double whammy. And look, it's just the responsibility of a wealthy country and a progressive government to look out for those who are most disadvantaged. And that right now is people who might be low income to begin with, might have less of an education to begin with, are in the face-to-face economy. They work in retail. They work in restaurants. They work at bars. They work in industries that in much of the country either aren't allowed by local ordinance or frankly shouldn't be allowed by local ordinance. I don't know exactly what percent of America is allowing people to crowd in indoor bars, but that should be absolutely illegal. It should not be allowed. That is a petri dish for the spread of COVID-19. So for a variety of, complex reasons, you have, as you alluded to, this sad scenario where the people who are most rent burdened are also those who are in the crosshairs of the pandemic.
We're talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic. We're talking about a looming housing crisis, he says, in the United States. People hit by COVID, having trouble making rent, paying mortgages, eviction moratoria coming to an end around the country, and the risk of a lot of people being put out of their housing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble, especially in the last couple of months, making that mortgage payment, that rent payment? Are you a landlord? Are you seeing your tenants having trouble making their payments? How's that affecting you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Derek, this is could be a trickle-up problem. Those landlords I mentioned, they're not going to be able to make their payments. Banks might be hit by this. This is a problem that ultimately wouldn't just affect the people who are having trouble paying for their housing in the first place, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. One way that I think about it is that you have a health crisis that is becoming an economic crisis, has become an economic crisis, and an economic crisis can become a financial crisis. And that's what you really, I mean, look, you don't want any of this. You know, you don't want a health crisis. You don't want an economic crisis. But we definitely don't want it to spiral into a financial crisis, which will make the economic crisis work. And when I say a financial crisis, I mean, I'm talking about not just the level of workers and people paying rent, paying mortgages on their homes, but also talking about the banks and the landlords and the companies that have, you know, bonds and their own obligations that could go that could become imperiled if you essentially have people not paying rent. You know, you can sort of knock down the dominoes one by one. If individuals can't pay rent, then the landlords aren't getting rent. If the landlords aren't getting rent, then in the short term, maybe they'll decide we're not going to pay for upkeep for this apartment. So the apartment is going to, it'll stink. They won't take out the trash. Things that are broken will stay broken. And then the medium term, a month or two later, those landlords might eventually realize that they can't pay their mortgages. They can't pay their own obligations. And so what happens is that they'll essentially be in foreclosure with their bank. The bank will take over the apartment. Maybe they'll cut off the lease agreements that they have with the current people who live in that apartment because they want to do various things that the pre-existing landowner didn't want to do, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you can see how this just spirals and becomes more of a disaster. You don't want it to spiral. You want to solve the problem now. And that problem can be solved with extending the CARES Act and also by extending a lot of these eviction moratoria.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Port Washington. Brad, hi.
How are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Brad?
Well, I am actually one of those low-income people that you are talking about. Actually, my low-income residence is Saukville. And it's even more dire than people would think, as well as the 30% rent, which basically almost puts me at about fair market value for this. I've also noticed that, and not just me, but, you know, other low-income properties and whatnot that I've, you know, talked with people about, they're not exactly upkept as far as drafts and things like that. So come wintertime, my heating bill is about $300 a month, and energy assistance gives me $700 for the entire season. Mind you, I've got two kids. So if my fair market value is roughly $825, I probably pay about $795 for the 30% of my income. You add another $300 for heat. That leaves me about $900 for 4 weeks to feed my family, do the gas, and any other bills that may happen. God forbid I have a tire that decides to blow out.
Brad, thank you so much for sharing that story, and good luck to you. Derek, precarious is the word that pops into my head there. If everything goes perfectly for Brad, it's tough, but he can make it, but there's not a lot of wiggle room there.
Absolutely. I mean, he's describing a situation where he has $225 every week to spend on food and necessities. I mean, it's inexcusable, and it's inexcusable in all sorts of ways that should be fixed under an administration that knows what it's doing. And I hope that it is fixed with expanded welfare laws and universal health insurance laws. In the meantime, we're not going to be able to overhaul, you know, welfare in the next month under this administration and with this Senate. And so what we can ask them to do, what we can demand that they do, is do what they did in March. Pass a law that allows for $1,000 to be delivered, $1,200 to be delivered to Mark's household. If he loses his job, to have unemployment insurance that has a $600 per week bump up that makes sure that he has more money to pay for his family, to pay for his food, to pay for his rent and everything else that he needs, including that tire. What we can do right now, it seems very obvious to me, but we're coming up very, very close to this eviction cliff. We're coming very, very close to August, where the law essentially expires, especially when it comes to unemployment insurance. It's unacceptable, and we just have to extend it.
We're talking about America's looming potential housing crisis with Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, the problems and possible solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Have you had trouble paying your rent, mortgage, or utilities during the pandemic? Are you or somebody you know facing eviction? Do you want to see action from the federal government, another round of relief from the damage to the economy from COVID-19? What would you want that to look like, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion about America's potential housing crisis accelerated by the coronavirus. Our guest says the housing problem has been years in the making. It's now dangerously close to spiraling out of control. Derek Thompson stays with us. He writes about economics, technology, and the media at The Atlantic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about losing your home? How has COVID-19 changed your financial situation, if at all? Are there policies or programs you would like to see from the state, from the federal government? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Robert is with us in Toma. Robert, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Robert?
I'm Toma calling again. Where's this money going to come from? We can't give people free money again. They have to go get a job, whether they like it or not. Mow the grass, babysit. It's all this privilege and stuff.
Robert, thanks for the call. Robert's saying there's not money really out there for the federal government, and people need to work harder to find jobs to deal with the situation, Derek.
Yeah, I disagree with Robert. I guess I disagree in at least two ways. First off, I'm not that concerned about where the money is going to come from. The reason to be concerned about a high deficit or large debt burden is that you fear you're going to you're going to crowd out investments. That's not really in danger of happening because the economy is on death's door right now. And also you're afraid about inflation, and inflation is really nowhere to be seen. So I'm not particularly concerned about deficits. I'm not concerned about the debt. I am concerned about people's ability, like Mark, to pay for rent and pay for food and pay for his kids and make sure that his car is still working. That's a far more urgent concern than inflation or any crowding out effect from deficit financed spending by the federal government. The other thing is that I don't think it is the case. The people who aren't working right now are not working because of laziness or because of privilege. I think the vast majority of people between 18 and 65 right now who are not working, I'll bet they want to work. I'll bet a lot of them want to work desperately. I'll bet a lot of them are looking for work every single day. And that is, I know, just an exhausting process and an existentially painful process to apply to job after job and recognize and feel like no one's listening to you. I mean, there's a lot of pain there, and it is pain and not privilege that I think defines the experience of the unemployed in America today. And so I think that we should absolutely deal with them with care, deal with them with grace and generosity, and continue to deficit finance the money that we are using to give them as they are prevented from working by a once-in-a-century pandemic.
Thanks for that call, Robert. We'll go to Tanner now in Madison. Tanner, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I just have a comment that I would like, you know, and kind of a question. You know, the government, the federal government, they're obviously not doing enough. We spend billions and billions of dollars on, you know, our military, new jets and tanks and all of that. If they could decide, oh, let's not buy 10 tanks and let's send all this few billion dollars back like a stimulus check like they have, why is that such a big deal for them? You know, and it's really not. I know it's not. They have billions and billions of dollars that they're
spending. Thanks a lot for the call. Tanner's saying not so much deficit funding, this kind of spending, Derek, but to reprioritize spending from the military.
Yeah, this is a look, I am if I, you know, were an advisor to an administration and they asked how we could reimagine the federal budget, which is a $4 trillion, I guess maybe this year, $5, $6, $7 trillion thing, I would definitely look at the possibility of reducing some military spending. We spend an extraordinary amount of money on the military, and some of it I think is very useful and necessary, and a lot of it I think is fantastically wasteful. At the same time, we don't need right now to think about this in a zero-sum way. We don't need to think of it as in order to have another $1 trillion bill to help the unemployed, we need to take that trillion from the military over the next decade. We don't have to think that way at all. We can just spend the money. If we have an issue with inflation going forward, that will likely, in many cases, mean that we got out of these doldrums of deflation that define the economic crisis. It'll be a possibly good thing. And frankly, we haven't had hyperinflation in this country I suppose we had inflation a little bit in the late 1980s, early 1990s, nothing like the 1970s, obviously, since the 1970s. That's 45 years. There's really no country in the developed world that's dealing with inflation. So I don't want to go on a whole thing about inflation, but the reason I go through that is to say, you know, the reason to think, oh no, we have to cut things in order to give the unemployed money. The only reason to think that is because you're living in a zero-sum mindset. And I'm saying we don't have to live in that mindset. We can run a huge, huge, huge deficit right now and not worry about it because of the macroeconomic conditions of the world.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about a potential looming housing crisis. We'll go back to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, I have a question. When you look at the history of this, President Bush gave us all $300, and Obama propped up the banks in the crisis of 2008. And when I ran for political office in 2008, I knew that there was going to be government money invested in private companies, and my Democratic opponent disagreed with that. But that's essentially what the government is doing, and they got their money back, you know. But what I'm wondering is, because the government is now giving us $1,200 stimulus checks and maybe it'll be 2,000. I mean, isn't it essentially, aren't we just becoming more dependent on government instead of becoming more independent as private citizens?
Jeff, thanks for the call. Jeff worried about us being too dependent on government checks.
Yeah, we are absolutely dependent on government right now, but we're dependent on government not because of any lack of rugged individualism. We're dependent on government because a pandemic that is a once-in-a-century outbreak is destroying communities and killing something like 800, 900 people every single day. Hundreds of thousands of people are becoming infected by this disease every single week right now. The pandemic is the economy in many ways. Where you have surges of the pandemic, you have the economy fall off a cliff. And we have to solve that health crisis. And you can't really solve a public health crisis as an individual. You can't really take it upon yourself to solve a public health crisis as a private individual. And so right now, we need government. We need government to step up across the board. We need guidance and clear communication from the federal government. We need testing apparatuses and tracing and isolation strategies that are guided by the CDC and the federal government. We need state governors to step up and say, people need to wear masks outside and inside. We need, you know, local governments and mayors and council members to understand their own local crises, because at the end of the day, this is a local disease. It's a local phenomenon, and make the appropriate rules to open and close various establishments as necessary. But, you know, without getting into a whole thing about, you know, Ayn Rand and rugged individualism versus progressive government, you know, right now we absolutely need governments to step up. We also need individuals to step up. We need individuals to recognize that they are not islands in the ocean. They are a part of a chain of transmission. And if they get sick, even if they feel like they can fight it, they might pass this disease along to 15 other people, some of whom might die. And so we need to think of ourselves as living socially, not socialistly necessarily, but socially, that our actions right now are exquisitely bound up in the fates of other people. And if we get sick and we come home to our families, you know, we can get all sorts of other people sick as well. So I would encourage people to be responsible and take, you know, individual responsibility seriously, but also recognize that there is a huge role for government to play in making sure that we collectively act to fight this disease.
We'll leave it there. Derek, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
That's Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at a possible housing crisis amid the pandemic and how he says Congress could help solve it. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll make some great summertime pies, get some recipes, share your favorites, that and more tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, get some great ideas for summertime reading with a trio of Wisconsin authors. And you can share your own suggestions. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then two researchers make the case that academic and scientific organizations need to do more to tackle issues of racism, more, they say, than just issuing statements. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.